We have three readings from Scripture today, from the Torah, from the book of Exodus, Moses' second trip up the mountain to receive the law, and his coming down from the mountain transformed. A reading from Psalm 99, and then the traditional reading for Transfiguration Sunday. It's found in each of the three Synoptic Gospels, and we'll be reading Matthew's version of that.
The Lord said to Moses, "Come up to me on the mountain and wait there, and I will give you the tablets of stone with the law and the commandment which I have written for their instruction." So Moses set out with his assistant Joshua, and Moses went up into the mountain of God. To the elders he had said, "Wait here for us until we come to you again, for Aaron and Hur are with you. Whoever has a dispute may go to them." Then Moses went up on the mountain, and the cloud covered the mountain. The glory of the Lord settled on Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it for 6 days. On the seventh day, he called to Moses out of the cloud. Now the appearance of the glory of the Lord was like a devouring fire on the top of the mountain in the sight of the people of Israel. Moses entered the cloud and went up on the mountain. Moses was on the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights.
The reading from Matthew takes place right after a pretty crucial scene where Peter, it sounds like, does really well for Peter, saying that, "You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God." And Jesus says, "Good answer." But then he goes on to explain what that means. It doesn't mean glory and victory. It means suffering and death. And Peter goes, "Oh, by no means, Lord. This can't happen. This is not what my idea was of Messiah." And Jesus says, "Get thee behind me, Satan." So Peter's in the midst of not having a clue, which is often where he's at. And then Jesus brings him and James and John up to a mountain.
"6 days later, Jesus took with him Peter and James and his brother John and led them up a high mountain by themselves. And he was transfigured before them, and his face shone like the sun, and his clothes became dazzling white. Suddenly there appeared to them Moses and Elijah talking with him. Then Peter said to Jesus, 'Lord, it is good for us to be here. If you wish, I will make three dwellings here, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah.' While he was still speaking, suddenly a bright cloud overshadowed them, and from the cloud a voice said, 'This is my Son, the Beloved. With him I am well pleased. Listen to him.' When the disciples heard this, they fell to the ground and were overcome by fear. But Jesus came and touched them, saying, 'Get up and do not be afraid.' And when they looked up, they saw no one except Jesus himself alone. As they were coming down the mountain, Jesus ordered them, 'Tell no one about the vision until after the Son of Man has been raised from the dead.'"
Thank you, Paul. This is a reading that I've preached on, oh my gosh, I think 30 times now. It's every year, the last Sunday of Epiphany. It's in each of the Synoptic Gospels, so all 3 years of the lectionary, we get this scene. And I've taken all sorts of different tacks on it. I've spent a lot of time making fun of Peter. deciding he was going to become a land developer up on top of the mountain. I need to make a gazebo. I need to make a memorial to this. I need to make this permanent. I've talked about mountaintop experiences and valley experiences. I've spent way too much time doing serious historical critical exegesis on it that put everyone to sleep. The filter I'm going to go through this week, and it might be a little soft and fuzzy, but it's going to be me as a dad and me as a husband. Now, the dad part is pretty easy. As those of you who are here regularly know, we have become empty nesters this year. Both our kids are at school, but I have to say, I really enjoy having my kids both in the Boston area for school. It's this great, they're both in the Boston-Cambridge area, and that's far away enough that they're not tempted to come home every weekend, which is really good. But it's close enough that Barb and I can get down there whenever there's a work thing happening in the Boston area. We're able to go down several times during the school year for a quick coffee or a dinner with the kids. We try to do it with one and then the other, so each of them can have some parent time. Which means that every time I see them, there have been several weeks since the last time I've seen them, and which means they look really different every time I see them. Sometimes startlingly so. I have found that I don't just have coffee with my daughter anymore. I am enjoying the company of this smart, complex, amazing young woman that I hadn't met before. And here she is. I'm not just sharing a burger and a beer with my son, but I'm out with this remarkable young man with all these adventures going on in his life. And each time I see them, they have moved a bit farther away from being the kids that Barb and I raised to being the adults that they are co-creating with God to be. They change and they grow, and when I don't see that as a daily continuum, it's a little shocking. They're different every time. Bodies change. It's what they do. Little bitty bodies grow in stature and strength to become mature bodies. It's what they do. Mature bodies grow in width and wrinkles. It's what they do. We do our best to avoid that. Our culture has multi-billion dollar markets based on slowing or halting or masking or reversing the slow but inevitable way our bodies change. And so we've got a cosmetics industry that promises everything under the sun. A plastic surgery industry, there's a fitness industry and a diet industry, all making wild and wonderful promises of youth and energy and seeming immortality if you just spend a lot of money doing this thing that we tell you to do. Buy this thing that we're offering. It seems that it's our faces especially that show our years and our experiences. The days and the seasons and the decades of sun and smiles and laughter and worry and tears and tragedies. Those years craft the lines around our eyes and our mouths and our forehead. They are slowly drawn maps of lives fully lived. Sometimes we see change in bodies that is objective and real, like our kids, like our aging bodies. Sometimes the change is in how we see or understand something. somehow how we see can change because we get gifted with a fresh perspective or new lenses of comprehension. There was a point a long time ago when Barb and I were dating, and that smart, sexy, scholastic girlfriend that I enjoyed so much looked different. I recognized in her eyes a depth and a resilience and a strength and a gentleness that was something I had not been looking for in a buddy or a girlfriend, but I had been looking for in someone I wanted to spend the rest of my life with, even if I could have never put it into words before that. Before my eyes, she was transformed from someone I enjoyed studying with and gabbing with and bicycling with and arguing theology with and smooching with to someone I wanted to spend the rest of my life with. And over the years, she has transformed and transfigured ever more before my eyes and I before hers. As we have shared together all the joys and the hurts and the betrayals and the forgivenesses and the loss and the grace and the pleasure that comes from 10,000 days lived out together and 10,000 nights wrapped tightly in each other's arms. You know, the word transformed might not be the best word. Maybe it's revealed. We've been revealed to each other more and more over the years. The truer reality of who we each are gets revealed to the other as we slowly learn to see the other more deeply and honestly and vulnerably. And in so doing, we witness the other transform before us or be revealed before us. I think that is what the readings of the season of Epiphany is about, and especially the strange reading called the Transfiguration. We see a revealing of who Jesus is at a truer and deeper level. The disciples witness directly and we witness vicariously the cloud of mystery being stripped away. The veil that sometimes concealed Jesus' deepest being is up on the mountaintop removed. And we see him as he truly is, the Son of God in shining radiance, the luminous reality beyond human words. That ultimate reality is what Paul called mysterion, the unknown ultimate truth that can only be revealed by God's will. And in our human experience, that becomes a luminous face, a mountaintop experience, a powerful divine voice uttering, "This is my Son, the Beloved, listen to him." And it's the gentle touch of Jesus saying, "Get up and do not be afraid." In Matthew's gospel, following Mark's, as Matthew describes it, Jesus' earthly form is transfigured into a more luminous reality. The Greek word is metamorphothein or metamorphothi, same root word as metamorphosis, the process of a caterpillar changing into a butterfly or any other radical change of form. Metamorphothi. But I don't think that process of caterpillar to butterfly can begin to portray the incredible vision on the mountain. Matthew has trouble, as much trouble as Mark did in describing Jesus. The Greek original says literally that Jesus' clothes were made white as the light. But that sounds more like a laundry detergent commercial than a supernatural happening. I'm not surprised that Matthew has trouble describing what Jesus looked like up on that mountaintop. It reminds me of a time I was in Israel, and we went to see these famous Chagall stained glass windows at a hospital in Jerusalem. Chagall was when we were doing the Matthew paintings. Those were of Moses rather. Those were by Chagall. These windows were breathtaking. Chagall's use of color and stuff is amazing. And I took picture after picture after picture, hoping to capture the radiance of the bright Israel sun shining through all that beautiful glass. And when my slides came back, this was in the day, slides, do you remember slides? Slides. They were terrible. They could not catch the reality of what my experience was in that hospital. The camera could not catch the radiance. And realize, how can you describe exactly what it looks like when sun comes through stained glass? If you were trying to tell someone who'd never been in a cathedral before what that experience is like, what words could you use to convey that amazing glow and that brilliance and the intensity of the color and the warmth? I can't even imagine trying to describe what Jesus looks like when the glory of God shone through him. It's no wonder the disciples said nothing about this awesome scene with Moses, the lawgiver, and Elijah, the prophet, and Jesus, the transfigured one, until later when they could see it through the experience of a crucifixion and a resurrection. They could put it into a context where it clicked and it made sense. They had to see it through an experiential rearview mirror, which is usually how it is with our experiences of the divine. We only get glimpses and clues and flashes of insight, usually after the fact when we go, aha, it was you all along. And it's usually impossible to describe any of these experiences to someone in a meaningful way, or at least a way that's meaningful to someone else. It's like trying to describe a dream. A friend of mine is a psychotherapist, and she says, people get so excited telling me about their dreams. There's nothing more boring in the world. There was a poll recently where some 60% of respondents claimed having had some kind of spiritual experience. But it was telling that only 20% had ever shared that experience with someone else. And I can understand that response. How do we describe a feeling of being made whole, a flash of comprehension, a glimpse of light, a gentle shower of calm, a sense of calling? How to share with someone in any way but the most coarse of metaphors? How will you not sound silly? How will you not be vulnerable? How will someone not think you're crazy? It seems impossible to share directly what it is to glimpse something of transcendence. Impossible to share, perhaps. But it is possible to respond when we've had that experience. It's possible to respond when we feel the gentle touch of Jesus saying, get up and don't be afraid. and it's time to come down from the mountaintop and go down to the world that needs someone who's experienced something of ultimate reality. How do we respond? How do we get up and don't be afraid? How do we respond to our experiencing Jesus, the Christ, the Son of the living God, the luminous, transcendent one, transfigured one? How do we respond? It may be that the best response is our being transformed and transfigured and grown and changed and living out of that new place, that new space. Maybe it's seeing ourselves with new lenses, obeying our calling to follow the loving, luminous one in a new way that we hadn't ever dared before, because we had been afraid. We hadn't felt touched by the hand of Christ. Whatever happened up there on the mountain, and the historical critical scholars can go on and on about this all day long, that's fine, but it doesn't matter ultimately to the meaning of it. Whatever happened up there on the mountain, the disciples came down different. The disciples came down changed to their very core. They saw Jesus differently. They saw the world differently. They listened differently. They operated differently. They came down the mountain. They went back to the crowds crying out for healing. They came back to religious authorities plotting an arrest. They came back to military authorities with their boots on the necks of an oppressed people. Their self-understanding was different, and so they operated different. Their calling was different. Now, they didn't do everything very well. They still abandoned Jesus when he was arrested. They still hid in an upper room. They still operated out of fear. But when they could see what happened through the lens of the resurrection, everything that happened up on that mountain made sense. The poet and artist Jan Richardson wrote, "The story of the Transfiguration is about opening our eyes to glory, allowing that glory to alter us, and becoming willing to walk where it leads us. The story urges us to trust that what we have seen, what we have known, will go with us. It assures us that the gifts received on the mountaintop will continue to illuminate us, not only on level ground, but even when we walk in the valley of the shadow of death." If you read ahead in Matthew's Gospel, you'll see that Jesus is heading toward Jerusalem, to a certain conflict, to a likely arrest, and as we readers know, a gruesome death. Perhaps their transfiguration experience on the mountaintop is what allowed them to follow Jesus, however imperfectly, into the most awful reality of discipleship. Perhaps the internal change they witnessed and underwent on the mountaintop is what gave them the ability to walk the deepest valley toward Golgotha. Perhaps after a crucifixion and a resurrection and a Pentecost, it was the remembrance of that glory on the mountaintop, in the clouds, that allowed them to go on listening and growing and changing. Listening in such a way as to love like Jesus did. To heal the sick and touch the outsiders like Jesus did. To teach the lost and cry out for the hurting and feed the hungry and stand for justice and walk for change. Listening in such a way as to take seriously those wild callings of his to forgive and love and reconcile and make new. To take seriously the blessings he bestowed on the peacemakers and the poor and the persecuted and the hurting. Maybe hearing the voice of God in the clouds is what allowed the disciples to listen for Jesus all the rest of their lives, listening enough to be open to change, to growth, to the movement of the Spirit, to being more like Jesus. And maybe, just maybe, to shine. Amen.